ASDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
We will do what we do strictly without consideration of political or any other extraneous factors.
Tensions mount between President Trump and the chair of the Federal Reserve.
Trump calls for Jerome Powell's termination this Thursday, April 17th, on All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. Agents from the Department of Homeland Security visited two elementary schools in Los Angeles County last week.
I speak with the superintendent who disputes the Trump administration's explanation for the visits.
This request for access was beyond the boundaries of what we legally would accept on a basis of existing federal law.
And how stop work orders from the federal government have halted some medical research at Harvard University.
Can you imagine that every administration comes in, we have to change what we teach in terms of ideology? That's not the United States I grew up in.
First, this news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Spear. Ukraine's president said a Trump administration envoy appears to be adopting Russia's narrative about the war it started in Ukraine as France brought American and European partners to Paris to find common ground. NPR's Joanna Kakissis has more from Kyiv.
The U.S. delegation in Paris included Steve Witkoff, a real estate mogul who has become an envoy to Russia. In an interview with Fox News, he said ending the war seems to hinge on five Ukrainian territories, which he did not name. Speaking to reporters in Kyiv, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky said Witkoff appears to be spreading Russian narratives. And he does not have the mandate to discuss Ukrainian territory, Zelensky said, because those belong to our people. Russia illegally annexed one Ukrainian region in 2014 and partially occupies four more. Zelensky says there can be no talks about territories without a ceasefire in place. Joanna Kakissis, NPR News, Kyiv.
Luigi Mangione, the man accused of killing UnitedHealthcare CEO Brian Thompson outside a Manhattan hotel, has now been indicted in a federal courthouse in New York on four charges, two counts of stalking, one count of murder with a firearm, and one firearms offense. Attorney General Pam Bondi has directed federal prosecutors to seek the death penalty. It is the first death penalty case the Department of Justice has sought since President Trump took office. 26-year-old Mangione was previously charged on multiple counts in both New York State and Pennsylvania in connection with Thompson's death. Police in Florida say a man is now in custody after killing two people and injuring six others on Florida State University's Tallahassee campus today. The alleged shooter is 20-year-old Phoenix Eichner, who's believed to be a student and is the son of a local sheriff's deputy. Douglas Soule with member station WUSF spoke to a student who was on campus at the time of the shooting.
First-year FSU student Anna Martins was sunbathing on the campus green when she heard screams.
So I dropped all my stuff. I was on the phone with my mom and I just started running.
Martins ran barefoot. She says she took shelter in a nearby church with about a dozen other students for hours.
It's so sad that we're in a place where we're supposed to feel safe on campus, getting an education. It's such an exciting part of our lives, college, and it's just so sad that we have to worry about things like this happening.
She says she is praying for those who were injured and killed. For NPR News, I'm Douglas Soule in Tallahassee.
Following remarks yesterday where Fed Chair Jerome Powell said President Donald Trump's tariff programs have the potential to slow economic growth and increase inflation, Trump today attacking the Fed chairman for not cutting interest rates. Trump also said he could fire Powell if he wanted to, though a number of Trump advisors have warned against that. Powell has previously said he has no intention of stepping down. A mixed close on Wall Street today. The Dow was down 527 points. The Nasdaq fell 20 points. The S&P rose 7 points. This is NPR. The latest assessment from the International Monetary Fund is that surging U.S. tariffs will likely weigh on global economic growth. As a result, the IMF's managing director is forecasting weaker growth and a rise in inflation. More details on that report are due out next week. IMF head Kristalina Georgieva saying sharp increases in the tariff are causing global uncertainties. The 19th century artist known as God's Architect is one step closer to becoming a saint. Claire Giangreva at Religious News Service in Rome has more on Antoni Gaudi.
Gaudi's most famous work is the Basilica of the Sagrada Familia in Barcelona, Spain, a building so grand that Gaudi died before completing it. It's a soaring cathedral that some have described as lifting you up to the sky. His work is so powerful that a number of people converted to Catholicism after visiting. Gaudí's faith and work were deeply intertwined. He was so devout that he once almost starved to death because of his rigid fasting during Lent. In order for Gaudí to become a saint, the Vatican will have to attribute two miracles to him, which could happen before his life's work in Barcelona is scheduled to be completed in 2026, on the centennial of his death. For NPR News, I'm Claire Giangrave in Rome.
There have been some good news in terms of the ability of some endangered types of sea turtles to bounce back worldwide. A study looked at 48 populations of turtles, measuring impacts of threats like hunting, pollution, and climate change. About half the areas examined, overall threats are declining. Atlantic Ocean turtles are doing better than those in Pacific waters. Scientists say leatherback turtles are not recovering as well. I'm Jack Spear, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Eric and Wendy Schmidt, through the Schmidt Family Foundation, working toward a healthy, resilient, secure world for all. On the web at theschmidt.org. This is NPR.
On a Thursday, it's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly in Washington.
And I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California. President Trump blasted the chairman of the Federal Reserve today for not lowering interest rates. Trump said in a social media post that Fed Chairman Jerome Powell's, quote, termination cannot come fast enough. And he later told reporters that he is disappointed with Powell's performance.
I don't think he's doing the job. He's too late, always too late. A little slow, and I'm not happy with him.
It's not the first time the president has clashed with Powell, demanding that the central bank lower borrowing costs. But Trump's own tariffs are making that more difficult. NPR's Scott Horsley joins us now. Hi, Scott.
Hi, Elsa.
Okay, so if this isn't the first time there's been conflict between Trump and Powell, what's behind this latest tension?
Well, the president's evidently frustrated that the European Central Bank lowered its benchmark interest rate today, while here in the U.S., the Federal Reserve has been holding rates steady at a fairly high level. Mm-hmm. Of course, Europe does not have the challenge we do in this country, where everything we import just got more expensive as a result of the president's tariffs. Powell gave a speech at the Economic Club of Chicago yesterday where he warned those tariffs are likely to push inflation higher, at least temporarily. And after all that we've gone through in the last few years, Powell said he and his Fed colleagues are determined to keep prices from spiraling out of control.
People hate inflation, and it's easy to understand why.
That's a big reason the Fed is not ready to cut interest rates, at least not yet.
Right. Okay, so what do you think Trump means when he says Powell's termination cannot come fast enough?
Trump wants a central banker who will follow orders from the White House, and that is not Jerome Powell. Even though it was Trump himself who appointed Powell as Fed chairman during his first term in the White House, Powell has jealously guarded the central bank's independence. And that's the way it's supposed to be. The Fed was deliberately structured to be insulated from just this kind of political pressure. Most of the time, presidents would like to see lower interest rates to goose the economy, although most of the time they're not as outspoken about that as Trump is. But experience shows following that path blindly is a recipe for runaway inflation. The Fed's job is to be the bad cop when necessary to get prices under control, and Powell says that's what he and his colleagues are trying to do.
We're never going to be influenced by any political pressure. People can say whatever they want. That's fine. That's not a problem. But we will do what we do. Strictly without consideration of political or any other extraneous factors.
Now, Trump insists inflation is already under control. He claims grocery prices are coming down, even though the latest government report says grocery prices were up last month. Trump boasts that oil prices have fallen, although he doesn't say that's because his trade war has sparked fears of a worldwide economic slowdown. The irony is inflation was coming down before Trump ordered all these big tariffs, and if he hadn't gone down that path, the Fed might soon be in a position where it could be cutting interest rates.
Right. Okay. Let me just ask you, Scott, could Trump simply fire the chair of the Fed?
Yeah, that's a market-moving question. Ousting Powell would almost surely spook financial markets even more than they already are. And Powell insists Trump does not have the authority to fire him. He says he can only be fired for bad behavior, not because of a disagreement over interest rates. And there's a Supreme Court case from the Franklin Roosevelt era that supports that, but the White House has signaled a willingness to test that precedent. Trump has already fired board members from other independent agencies, so the Supreme Court may get another crack at this question. In the meantime, Powell insists he plans to serve out his term, which runs through next spring.
That is NPR's Scott Horsley. Thank you so much, Scott.
You're welcome.
The federal government imposed stop work orders for several labs at Harvard University on Tuesday, halting billions of dollars in federally funded research. It is one of the immediate impacts of the fight between the Trump administration and Harvard. And one person who received a stop work order is Dr. Don Ingber. He's the founding director of the Wyss Institute at Harvard, which focuses on developing medical technologies. Welcome.
Hi, thank you.
Hi. Okay, so I understand that the Wyss Institute had three contracts impacted by the stop work order, totaling roughly, let me make sure I'm getting this right, $20 million in research. What were your teams working on?
My group is using a technology that we developed here called human organs on chips that are small devices the size of a computer memory stick that have hollow channels that are literally lined by living human cells that we position to recreate the structures of living organs, and they actually replicate the functions and responses of living organs.
Wow.
And so they have funded us to study how the human lung, intestine, bone marrow, and lymph node respond to radiation, and we've been really successful at doing that. And then also to develop to identify drugs that can mitigate the effects of radiation.
For example, for astronauts during space travel.
Well, you're never going to get to Mars, even if Elon Musk thinks is the most important thing in the world, unless you figure out how to protect astronauts against radiation toxicity. But it also would be there to protect against nuclear reactor disasters. And again, we're at a time where the government wants to build nuclear plants all over the country because of the AI energy needs. And also cancer patients, you know, receive radiotherapy.
Yeah.
And there are side effects that these types of drugs can mitigate.
So how did you personally feel when you got this stop work order? What went through your mind?
I was a bit surprised because this work is totally unrelated to anything that you can imagine related to wokeness or anti-Semitism. Mm-hmm. I also, the Wyss Institute is a separate 501c3, although it's part of Harvard. All of our direct costs and indirect costs go 100% to research and technology development. So I honestly don't understand why they targeted us.
And can you just explain for people what are the immediate effects in your labs for this screeching halt in work? Like what happens to the employees, to the experiments?
Well, the experiments have to stop. And obviously, if there are experiments that are, you know, partway through, I have to come up and find alternative sources of funding to keep these people who are, these are all young people who are passionate, working day and night on these things. Mm-hmm. And so we have to protect them. That's my first priority. And then we want to save any experiments that are critical, which took months to do and we lose data. But otherwise, we are, you know, we basically have to bring it to a halt unless we can find other funding. And that's what, you know, we're in the damage assessment phase.
Well, Alan Garber, Harvard's president, was pretty firm in his response. He was quoted in a post on X from the Harvard account saying, quote, "No government, regardless of which party is in power, should dictate what private universities can teach, whom they can admit and hire, and which areas of study and inquiry they can pursue." What's your feeling about that statement, given what you have at stake here with all these projects?
I'm proud to be a Harvard faculty member because you have to speak truth to power. You know, can you imagine that every administration comes in, we have to change what we teach in terms of ideology? That's not the United States I grew up in. We have to have academic freedom. America is the magnet for the world's best and brightest all around the world, every nation, even China. They all want to come here. That is what built our scientific powerhouse, which has led to the incredible technologies that, you know, optical fibers, computer microchips, CRISPR technology, you name it. That's what's driven the economy. That is our economic competitiveness that the government talks about. They are now strangling that pipeline in every which way, you know, and so we're killing the gem that we have created through a partnership between government and academia for the past 70 years, and it makes no, there's no reason for it. Right? It goes against everything they say they want to do.
That is Dr. Don Ingber of the Wyss Institute at Harvard University. Thank you so much for speaking with us.
My pleasure.
Christian leaders gathered outside the U.S. Capitol building this week to do two things. First, protest the Trump administration's executive orders on gender. And second, call for more solidarity with LGBTQ people within their churches. This conversation has been particularly fraught in Black denominations, as Adele Banks of Religion News Service reports.
We lift up every queer clergy member who is gathered here today, every faith leader who dares to stand and preach love in the face of hate.
This is the Reverend Anika Wilson Brown, who leads Union Temple Baptist Church, a Black church in Washington, D.C.
Let us proclaim loudly that we will stand together. We will stand unbroken.
While Wilson Brown's church has become more affirming of LGBTQ people, no major historically Black denomination has issued an official statement doing this, and some, like the African Methodist Episcopal Church, have banned clergy from performing same-sex marriages. Its rulebook states, quote, "Unions of any kind between persons of the same sex or gender are contrary to the will of God." Bishop Reginald Jackson is a leader in the AME Church.
I think most of the major Black denominations in terms of its membership is divided, is split, which is one of the reasons why no definitive position has been taken. I'm not sure how much longer that can continue, but that's where we are now.
Jason Shelton is a scholar at the University of Texas at Arlington. He says the AME Church is at a crossroads.
If the AME Church is to be more open and affirming, some of those young people who were AME, grew up AME and are LGBTQ, might be willing to come back. And how do you get them back? Well, the first step is to open the door to them.
Pride in the Pews is an organization seeking just that. The Reverend Don Abram is its founder. He trains Black congregational leaders to welcome LGBTQ people in the sanctuary and to advocate for queer rights in the public square.
As queer and trans siblings are under attack, we've gathered simply to say not on our watch.
Abram sees public demonstrations like this rally at the Capitol as important, but says Black LGBTQ liberation will never fully happen without the Black church. For NPR News, I'm Adele Banks.
And that story was produced through a collaboration between NPR and Religion News Service. You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Cunard, offering travelers an opportunity to voyage aboard Cunard's Queen Elizabeth to Alaska. Guests can experience Glacier Bay National Park and Hubbard Glacier, as well as locally sourced cuisine. Learn more at Cunard.com. From Charles Schwab, offering investors choices like full-service wealth management, advice, investing, and trading on Thinkorswim. Learn more at Schwab.com. And from listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Elsa Chang. On Monday of last week, federal agents from the Department of Homeland Security visited two elementary schools in Los Angeles County. In both cases, school administrators denied these officers entry. In a statement to NPR, Homeland Security Assistant Secretary Tricia McLaughlin touted her department's efforts to ensure the safety of children who came unaccompanied to the U.S., and she wrote, quote, "Any assertions that officers lied are false. Our law enforcement clearly identified themselves and made it clear this was a welfare check and not an immigration enforcement action." Well, the man who leads the L.A. Unified School District is refuting Homeland Security's statements. This week, I spoke with Superintendent Alberto Carvalho and asked him what happened in these two incidents.
It appears that the agents that approached both schools happened to have been part of the same team. They approached the school asking for access to a number of students.
And what did these agents ask about these particular children?
Well, they never conveyed to our teams the intent of their visit. We have a fairly rigid set of protocols specific to these types of actions. We trained for this during the latter part of last year, because we in fact anticipated this type of action would occur in Los Angeles, considering the demographic profile of our community and of our student body.
Sure, and what is that protocol when schools get visits from immigration authorities?
Sure, when schools get visits from anyone asking information about our students, we follow the law. Number one, we follow federal law, the constitutional law that guarantees, independently of immigration status, a free public education to all students, no questions asked. That's under the Equal Protection Clause of our Constitution. Secondly, we are duty-bound and legally bound to follow FERPA, which is the Federal Education Privacy Act that declares confidentiality associated with information specific to students or parents. And thirdly, and this is critically important, we follow in loco parentis, which means that in the absence of a guardian or a parent, school officials act as the parent, protecting their interests and their rights.
I'm curious, how did the schools respond specifically in these two incidents?
So in these instances, when the agents approached school staffs, principals politely asked them for identification, and that is part of the protocol. When the principals attempted to write the names of individuals and their ID numbers, they quickly pocketed their IDs, saying that that was not allowed. Secondly, part of the protocol is an immediate call to our legal department, as well as our operations, as well as our school board police department. Then we ask for a judicial warrant, which is the necessary paperwork to have access to anyone within our school site. That is the equivalent of a criminal subpoena. If there is no judicial warrant appropriately signed by a judge, then we deny the request.
And to your knowledge, these individuals have not tried to contact the children directly. Do you know?
To the best of our knowledge, that has not taken place. What I can tell you is this, that while at school, they did convey to the principals that they had authorization from the relatives of these children, from their parents, to have access to them, which seems contradictory to the statement provided by the Department of Homeland Security after these actions, which basically conveyed that these were wellness checks based on the fact that these were unaccompanied minors.
Let me ask you about that specifically, the position of the Department of Homeland Security, because they have said that these agents were from specifically the Homeland Security Investigations Agency doing what they call wellness checks, and that, quote, this had nothing to do with immigration enforcement. Let me just ask you, Superintendent, are wellness checks by Homeland Security officers typical at elementary schools?
We have no evidence, nor do I have information of a wellness check conducted by the Department of Homeland Security having taken place in Los Angeles, not only this year, last year, or going back a number of years. Secondly, I've spoke with a number of colleagues across the country who lead large districts. Mm-hmm. They too have no evidence that these types of visits or checks have taken place.
So do you personally believe DHS's claim here that these were wellness checks?
What I do believe is this. I have heard repeatedly that a number of different federal agencies were collaborating with ICE in the enforcement of immigration law. I've heard also requests being made of local law enforcement entities to join in that process. So we have to accept at face value that this request for access was beyond the boundaries of what we legally would accept on a basis of existing federal law and the protections that must be afforded to our children, specific to their privacy, confidentiality. And by the way, how would you feel if you were a parent of a child in your school and somebody called you and said, you know what, Homeland Security or the FBI or the Secret Service or ICE showed up at the school and we provided them direct access to your child,
right?
Even if your child was a native-born American? You would be incensed. That is not the kind of thing that you expect would take place in any school.
Well, let's touch on what you said earlier. You said that Homeland Security officials said that they had contacted caretakers or parents of these children that they were asking questions about. Have you been in touch with those parents or caretakers to confirm whether or not DHS officials contacted them?
Our school teams did, in fact, make contact with individuals who are the caretakers of these children, and they categorically denied extending permission to any entity, federal, state, or local entity, to have access to their kids in school. That is why we categorically refute the agency's statement that this was nothing more than a wellness check, and it is blatantly untrue that any type of authorization was provided to these individuals by the caretakers of these children.
I want to bring your own personal story into this, because in a press conference about these incidents, you mentioned that you yourself were an undocumented immigrant, and then you became a teacher, a principal, mm-hmm. and now a superintendent. Do you feel it is the responsibility of school districts to stand up for undocumented students?
I certainly do. Look, I've been in this country many years. I'm a proud American by choice, not by chance. I arrived here as a poor young teenager. I was once homeless in this country. I know what the fear of your life circumstance can be and the impact it can have on a young person. I still feel it today. I taste it. I remember it. So once an immigrant, always an immigrant. Once poor, always poor. Once homeless, always homeless. And I would be the biggest hypocrite in the world if I did not fulfill my professional and moral responsibility of fending for, defending, protecting individuals, children who today find themselves in the same exact predicament I experienced over four decades ago.
That is Alberto Carvalho. He's the superintendent of the Los Angeles Unified School District. Thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thank you for the opportunity.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
The Canton Fair is the oldest trade fair in China and one of the largest in the world.
We've got karaoke machines, we've got keyboards, we've got mini blenders, we've got fans, we've got people selling everything.
What impact might President Trump's tariffs have on China's economic growth? That story tomorrow on Morning Edition from NPR News.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. New evidence from the James Webb Space Telescope suggests possible life on another planet.
The clue is a molecule found in the atmosphere of this very far-off planet.
These are the first hints we are seeing of an alien world that is possibly inhabited.
First, the news.
Live from NPR News in Culver City, California, I'm Dwayne Brown. President Trump says his team is exploring a plan to deport U.S. citizens and lock them up in prisons overseas. Legal scholars say the idea is unconstitutional, but they fear Trump may try it, even if courts and judges object. NPR's Brian Mann has more.
Trump has repeatedly raised the idea of deporting Americans involved in criminal activity and jailing them outside the U.S. This week, he urged El Salvador's president to build more prisons to house U.S. citizens. Constitutional experts, including David Beer at the Cato Institute, a libertarian think tank, told NPR that would be unconstitutional, but they believe it could happen.
That's the real fear that we have now, is that he is going to try to evade judicial review of deportations of U.S. citizens.
In an opinion published last week, Supreme Court Justice Sonia Sotomayor also voiced concern about possible deportation of U.S. citizens. Speaking on Fox News, Attorney General Pam Bondi said Trump's proposal could reduce crime. Brian Mann, NPR News.
A mass shooting at Florida's largest university today has left two people dead and six others injured in Tallahassee. Leon County Sheriff Walter McNeil says the 20-year-old shooter who was taken into custody is the son of one of his deputies.
Our deputy Eichner, has been with the Leon County Sheriff's Office for over 18 years. She has a tremendous job that she's done. Her service to this community has been exceptional. Unfortunately, her son had access to one of her weapons, and that was one of the weapons that was found at the scene.
The alleged shooter, Phoenix Eichner, was well aware of law enforcement protocol. The sheriff says he was a long-standing member of the Youth Citizen Advisory Council, and the sheriff says he wasn't surprised he had access to weapons. This is NPR. The Trump administration's sweeping staffing cuts at federal lands agencies are causing anxiety across the tender, dry Southwest. NPR's Kirk Sigler says the wildfire threat is already severe.
The Trump administration says wildland firefighters continue to be exempt from the federal hiring freeze, but an untold number of Forest Service staffers who hold red cards, meaning they can leave their day jobs to fight fires, were laid off in February. One of them in New Mexico is Kayla, whose full name we aren't using because she fears retaliation.
Yeah, I just feel like if it's a ticking time bomb, like, I feel like we were doing everything in our power to help prevent this, the catastrophic fires.
She recently got her job back after a court ruling, but says Forest Service staff are, quote, walking on eggshells, and all the work that goes into protecting communities and wildlife from wildfires is on hold. Kirk Sigler, NPR News, Santa Fe.
Officials in Puerto Rico are demanding answers as crews work to restore power after a second blackout in a month across the entire island. The main airport and several hotels filled with Easter vacationers were affected. Crews have restored power to about 58% of the island today after more than a million customers were left without electricity. The cause of the power outage has yet to be determined. Stocks continue to fall on Wall Street. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at Indeed.com/NPR. From The Nature Conservancy, committed to protecting and preserving the planet during Earth Month and every month through the bold power of local and global action. Nature.org/NPR. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Mary Louise Kelly in Washington.
And I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California. Today, the Supreme Court briefly deferred any ruling on President Trump's claim that there is no automatic guarantee to birthright citizenship in the Constitution. The court said that it would hear arguments in the case on May 15th, with a decision likely by late June or early July. Joining us now to explain what all of this means is NPR Legal Affairs correspondent Nina Totenberg. Hi, Nina.
Hi, Elsa.
Okay, so we've been seeing lots of orders issued by the Supreme Court dealing with various challenges to other executive orders from Trump. This one is different, right? Explain why.
Well, I think it's different because the court undoubtedly thought it just couldn't poke Trump in the eye, or for that matter, poke the lower courts in the eye, and just kiss off the outcome without having full briefing and oral arguments.
All right. And tell us why that matters.
Look, this case is a huge deal. Trump issued his executive order banning birthright citizenship on day one of his administration. To now, every court to have considered that order has blocked it. But he's doggedly persisted in his contention that birthright citizenship is unconstitutional. That idea, I should point out, has been widely considered a fringe view because the Supreme Court ruled to the contrary 127 years ago, and that decision has never been disturbed. So if you think about the court's activity in the last few weeks, issuing orders without full briefing and oral arguments, the court's liberal justices have just skewered the conservative majority for being willing to issue short, sometimes impenetrable orders without having full briefing and oral argument that would allow the justices more time to consider all the difficult aspects of these cases. The liberals didn't use this language, but basically they have been saying repeatedly that these previous cases, in these previous cases to the conservatives, they've been saying, you can't just pop off the minute the Trump administration comes running to us for help. You got to really hear the arguments and think about it.
And do we have a sense, Nina, of any specific questions the court might be asking?
So far, we have just to presume that the main question is whether Trump is right, and there is no automatic right to citizenship. There was nothing in the court's order, at least so far, that would suggest it'll take up the administration's complaints about single district court judges issuing nationwide court orders on this and other matters. To date, every court to have considered his executive order banning birthright citizenship has blocked it. But the president isn't giving up, despite the fact that his anti-birthright citizenship view is widely considered a fringe view.
Fringe, that word again. Explain why you are using that word.
Because, as I said before, the Supreme Court ruled definitely 127 years ago that there is a constitutional right to birthright citizenship. And that decision has never been disturbed. As the states challenging Trump's executive order put it in their Supreme Court brief, for over a century, it's been the settled view of this court, Congress, the executive branch, and legal scholars that the 14th Amendment Citizenship Clause guarantees citizenship to babies born in the United States, regardless of their parents' citizenship, allegiance, domicile, immigration status, or nationality.
And remind us what the 14th Amendment says.
It says all persons born or naturalized in the United States and subject to the jurisdiction thereof are citizens of the United States. Trump, however, has long argued that there is no such thing as automatic citizenship, and at least not for all babies born in the U.S. if their parents were not born here and thus were not under the jurisdiction of the United States. And so the last word will go to the Supreme Court.
That is NPR's Nina Totenberg. Thank you, Nina.
My pleasure.
A distant planet shows hints of having alien life. That is the provocative claim being made by a team of scientists that used the James Webb Space Telescope to probe this planet's atmosphere. They believe they have spotted sulfur-based gases that here on Earth are produced by living things. But as NPR's Nell Greenfield-Boyce reports, there are reasons to be skeptical.
The researchers say they're being cautious in how they're interpreting their new results, but at the same time, they say it's the strongest evidence yet that life may exist outside our solar system, potentially one of the biggest landmarks in the history of science.
And I know this, you know, sounds grand, and it's not my intention to make it sound grand, but there is no other way to put it.
That's Niku Madhusudan at the University of Cambridge. He called this a revolutionary moment.
These are the first hints we are seeing of an alien world that is possibly inhabited.
The planet his team studied is K2-18b. It's about 124 light years away, and it orbits its star in the Goldilocks zone, where temperatures are not too hot and not too cold to have liquid water. As this planet passed in front of its star, researchers saw the starlight interacting with molecules in the planet's atmosphere. That gave them clues about the atmosphere's chemical makeup. They saw signs of dimethyl sulfide and dimethyl disulfide. These gases, in Earth's atmosphere, are only made by living things, like microbes in the ocean.
This is an insanely difficult measurement.
Laura Kreidberg is at the Max Planck Institute for Astronomy in Germany. She wasn't part of the research team, and she says astronomers are still learning how to use the powerful James Webb Space Telescope to tease out details about planets' atmospheres.
It's a tricky business. These are really, really small signals. We've just been at it for a couple of years.
So she's not convinced.
I think this is one of those situations where extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence.
Maybe those telltale gases aren't even really there. In just days, this telescope data will be publicly available. Other astronomers will surely pounce on it and do their own independent analyses. Måns Holmberg is with the Space Telescope Science Institute. He's one of the researchers who reported these new findings. He says they need to be confirmed by other scientists and more telescope observations.
Any claim of life on another planet requires a lot of justification. And I don't think we're there yet. Like, if someone asks, have you found life on this planet? The answer is no.
One reason is that on this alien world, it's possible that these gases are made by some unknown process that doesn't require life at all. Some geologic system that planetary scientists haven't even dreamed of. Nicole Lewis is an exoplanet scientist at Cornell University. She says the James Webb Space Telescope has kicked off a new phase in the study of small planets beyond our solar system. But because its ability to probe atmospheres for signs of possible life is so new, it can be hard to know what to make of the data.
And I'll be honest, I mean, I have my own data that I sit there and scratch my head about it all the time. Like, do I believe that bump or wiggle? Is that bump or wiggle unique? Right.
That's why she thinks these new findings are interesting and need to be followed up, but says she's not running outside and screaming, aliens! Nell Greenfield Boyce, NPR News.
Every week, there is a new main character, someone or something that the internet becomes obsessed with. This week, TikTok has been flooded with videos from Chinese manufacturers urging Americans to buy directly from them, claiming that they make exact replicas of luxury goods like Hermes purses for a fraction of the price.
The same person behind these Hermes videos has also done the same videos for cars, saying that, you know, we can manufacture Western cars for cheaper. What are the chances that the guy who specializes in Hermes bags also specializes in EV cars and all of these other categories of goods?
This week's main character, the Chinese luxury goods conspiracy. Tune in to All Things Considered tomorrow. And you're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. Okay, and now we're going to check in on the standoff between President Trump and the governor of Maine. Yesterday, the Attorney General, Pam Bondi, announced that the Department of Justice is suing Maine over its policy that allows transgender athletes to compete in women's sports. The state's Democratic governor, Janet Mills, spoke about it today, and we're joined now by Maine Public Radio's Kevin Miller to discuss what's become a pretty high-profile showdown. Hi, Kevin.
Hi, Elsa.
Okay, so what did the governor have to say today?
Well, the governor said she felt confident in the state's defense. Mills said the Justice Department didn't cite any case law to support the president's interpretation of Title IX, which is the non-discrimination law governing women's sports. But Governor Mills is also a former state attorney general, so she says she's happy to litigate these issues in court. But then Mills also had a message for other governors.
Let today serve as a warning to other states as well. Maine may be among the first to draw fire in the ire of the federal government in this way, but we will not be the last.
And every few days, there's another investigation or a warning letter that we're seeing. And Maine is a small state, so we typically don't draw a lot of attention from D.C.
Yeah, so remind us how this whole dispute started.
Yes, so it all started 2 months ago, and that's when Mills was at a meeting with other governors in the White House.
Mm-hmm.
Trump threatened at that time to cut off federal funding for the state unless Maine bans transgender athletes in girls' sports. And Mills replied, quote, "See you in court." So since then, the administration has attempted to cancel research grants and support money for food assistance programs. They even briefly blocked parents in Maine from being able to get Social Security numbers for their newborns while at the hospital. And then last week, the U.S. Department of Education began a process that could eliminate federal K through 12 funding. And in that case, we're talking about potentially hundreds of millions of dollars.
And why does the Trump administration say it's doing all of this?
Yeah, so the administration says that they're trying to protect women and girls. They say by allowing athletes who were born as males to compete in girls and women's sports, it's not only unfair, but potentially dangerous. And then Attorney General Pam Bondi said on Wednesday that it's not just Maine. They want other states to comply. And I talked to Mark Brewer. He's a political science professor at the University of Maine. And he says that the goal here seems to be basically making an example of institutions that might disagree with the White House on this issue or other issues.
The other states that follow it, or the same thing's going to happen to you. Same thing with, you know, with Columbia or Harvard or who, Penn, whoever it's going after. It makes a lot more sense from an implementation standpoint to set the example with one instance and then get other similar actors to comply rather than having to take the time and the resources to go after each one individually.
And more than 20 other states had, at least until recently, similar policies to Maine on transgender athletes.
So what's next in this standoff in Maine, you think?
Yeah, so, well, Republicans in Maine say that the state should give Trump what he wants and change the law on transgender athletes. Democrats so far are backing Mills, but they also say the president can't cut money for hundreds of schools and nutrition programs over his interpretation of a law, especially since the Principals Association here says there's only two known transgender athletes in school sports this year. But ultimately, it looks like this will be headed to the U.S. Supreme Court.
That is Kevin Miller of Maine Public Radio. Thank you, Kevin.
Thank you very much.
You're listening to All Things Considered. From NPR News, it's All Things Considered. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Elsa Chang. To New Mexico now, where people are already worried about wildfires after an extremely dry winter. Some in the state say that the Trump administration is making things worse as it tries to eliminate thousands of jobs from the U.S. Forest Service, the country's lead firefighting agency. NPR's Kirk Sigler has the latest.
When the federal government controls more than half of the land in the American West, so much of everyday life is tethered to the federal agencies that manage it.
So these cabins were built for the loggers and their families.
Brian Letty owns one of these historic cabins on land he leases from the U.S. Forest Service. Here in the remote Zuni Mountains of northwestern New Mexico, there should still be snow and mud under these tall pines. Instead, it's alarmingly dry.
I think the fire season is on everyone's mind right now.
Adding to the anxiety, Letty says, is a more man-made problem. The funding cuts to federal lands agencies by Elon Musk's DOGE, and namely the elimination of hundreds of Forest Service jobs, with reports that thousands more could follow.
Like, what's going to happen if a fire starts? Who's going to respond to that? You know, and right now it doesn't feel like there's a lot of confidence that the federal government is going to be able to act and respond accordingly.
The Trump administration says wildland firefighting positions continue to be exempt from the federal hiring freeze. The Forest Service declined an interview request, but in an email said its operational readiness is, quote, not impacted. But there's more to the story. An untold number of probationary employees fired in February alone also carry red cards, meaning when there's a fire, they leave their regular jobs to help out. People like Kayla, whose full name we aren't using because she fears retaliation.
It was like a slap to the face. It's shocking to me that our position could be taken away that easily without thorough investigation on exactly what we do and how we perform.
Well, Kayla has been rehired for now, but morale is down, she says, and the work that actually helps protect the land and wildlife from fires isn't getting done.
With the loss of so many positions, it just seems impossible at this moment. And it's scary. It's really scary.
Other federal workers told me the same, but didn't want to be recorded. When the administration froze all federal funding for review last winter, they say slash piles and forests went unburned and are now sitting there like matchbooks. Wildfire prevention grants with any connection to climate change or diversity, this is heavily Hispanic northern New Mexico, were scrapped. And elite firefighting teams are half their normal staffing or worse. Meanwhile, Trump ordered the Forest Service to boost logging by 25% to address the fire crisis. In Santa Fe, Eitan Kreselovsky runs the Forest Stewards Guild, which the agency contracts out to for on-the-ground work.
If you have turmoil in your 9-to-5 work environment, you're not going to be able to show up at the incidents, at the prescribed burns, to run all the timber sales or fuels management projects. Like, you know, that system needs to function.
And with wildfires already burning here, people feel like it's not.
You know, and it could change tomorrow, too, right? Are people still in their positions? Have they been rehired?
Anjanette Brush is a Taos County commissioner.
I think what we do see is that there's nothing really super efficient about going through the process of firing, rehiring, firing, going to court.
Brush says locals deserve to know that the federal government has their backs. And right now, she says, it doesn't feel like it.
These folks are not, you know, some faceless freeloaders. They are our family, our friends,
even
our
in Democratic-leaning New Mexico, there are long-standing tensions against federal lands agencies. A century ago, the Hispanos in northern New Mexico resisted the then new Forest Service restrictions on grazing. In 2022, the agency lit prescribed burns that became the largest wildfire in state history.
Today, there's a lot of red tape.
Back in the Zuni Mountains, Bill Siebersma thinks the government is too big. But he also has a popular bipartisan bumper sticker on his Jeep, Public Lands Owner. He's worked for years with the local Forest Service office building mountain bike trails up here.
There's people in the bureaucracy, I suppose, who aren't doing much. Yeah, I'd love to see them out because we don't want to put our tax money into supporting scammers.
More immediately, New Mexicans are waiting to see how true the Forest Service's promises are that it's ready for what could be a long fire season. Kirk Sigler, NPR News, Santa Fe.
As springtime celebrations unfold across the country, a familiar sight fills parks and backyards, brightly colored eggs cracked open with a burst of confetti. Known as cascarones, these festive eggshells are a staple of Easter and vibrant celebrations in the Southwest. Lucio Vasquez from the Texas Newsroom reports on the origins of the colorful tradition.
Few things are as satisfying as showering an obnoxious layer of confetti over someone's head. Just like hunting for painted eggs, cracking cascarones is a playful staple of Easter festivities for families here in Texas. Cindy Dodds from Dallas has made sure her two boys have had cascarones every year. Last year, her 9-year-old's birthday party became a war zone of confetti.
We had the kids running around in our backyard, hiding and throwing eggs at each other until they were exhausted.
But what is a cascarón? Well, it begins with an empty eggshell.
You wash it clean, let it dry, and then after it's dry, you paint it. You let that dry, you fill it with confetti, and after it's all good and dry, you can crack it over someone's head.
That's Judy Simon, chair of the Cascarones Committee for NIOSA, an annual festival celebrating the cultural legacy of San Antonio, Texas. Her group is affectionately known as the Egg Ladies. They meet every Thursday year-round to create tens of thousands of cascarones.
We always say the more confetti you have in your hair, the more popular you are. And also it wishes people good luck.
While historians aren't sure where cascarones originated, Simon says they're believed to have come from China centuries ago.
And these weren't the kind of cascarones we know today. They were perfume-filled eggs, and they were given as gifts.
Simon says it's believed that Marco Polo himself brought these eggs to Europe, where they became a symbol of celebration among Spaniards. Eventually, cascarones arrived in Mexico, where they took on their modern form, filled with confetti instead of perfume. The tradition then spread into the U.S., where it became a cherished part of celebrations like Easter. It's also become synonymous with Mexican-American celebrations, like the yearly festival Fiesta in San Antonio.
You're having a party, you have cascarones. Easter, you have cascarones. Fiesta, cascarones.
But despite the storied history, the future of cascarones is what we make of it. Cindy Dodds and her family have adopted the tradition as their own. She hopes it'll create lasting memories for her children.
I think it's a bonding moment that they will remember as they get older. And when they're sitting around with their own kids and creating traditions, they'll remember this one and laugh, and maybe they'll do it with their children.
So next time you crack a cascarón, remember, it's more than just confetti. It's history and tradition in your hands. For NPR News, I'm Lucio Vasquez.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Arm, committed to delivering innovative, advanced computing designed to enable worldwide companies to unleash the capabilities and experiences of AI. The future of AI is built on Arm. Arm.com. From EasyCater, a business tool for food, designed to help organizations order food for meetings and events from restaurants nationwide, set up employee lunch programs, and manage food spend at EasyCater.com. From Progressive Insurance with Snapshot, a personalized program that bases rates on safe driving habits at progressive.com, not available in California or from all agents.